experiences.
It's the supersized data edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Earth 2.4, suppressing ESP, barefaced citizens addicted to sex, and bio data avalanche. Let's begin episode 145.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sort, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Dawn, your political science philosopher.
Jenna, your biochemist.
You know, Ethan, this week has been so depressing.
It has been, hasn't it?
Well, you know, I mentioned last week, you know, about the Durban conference and climate change and how the end is near. And just as, I mean, Harper hates me, just to rub salt into my wound, right? The Kyoto Protocols, which expire next year. So what has Canada done? Canada says, well, we're going to withdraw from the protocols, which we really haven't done anyhow, this year, even though they expire next year, just as sort of a F you to the world, which, I don't know, it just struck me as so bizarre. I mean, seriously, this world is done for. Is there any hope for us to find someplace new to live?
Well, amazingly, recently, Don, we may have found such a planet, but it could be taken by the natives of this interesting new world, which is called Kepler-22b. I'm assuming that's not what the natives of Kepler-22b actually call the planet, probably something a bit more fancy. Anyway,
like Earth.
Well,
very fancy.
Yeah. This planet, although it's not the first to be discovered in the quote-unquote Goldilocks orbit, it is one of the first ones that we found that is, you know, relatively speaking, not that far away. 600 light years, which is still far, but not that far. This planet orbits a star called Kepler-22, and it takes about 290 days to circle the star once.
Oh, I get the name now.
Yeah, because it's Kepler.
The star is 22, and it's 22. The second planet.
Yeah.
Does that make us like Sun 3?
Wasn't our star called Sol?
Yeah,
so we'd be Sol 3.
Jenna, you really need to brush up on your science.
Either that or my French.
Yeah. Anyway, this interesting new planet.
Wait, I think that's Spanish.
Sol.
Go ahead.
I don't know. If you know the answer to whether Sol is Spanish or French, either,
I think it's Soleil in French.
So anyway, this planet, because it orbits a star at about this, you know, similar distance from Earth, you know, around our sun, it's in that zone where liquid water could exist. And if liquid water exists, well, maybe life exists as well. Now, the star Kepler-22 is a bit colder, but the planet is a bit closer, so it kind of compensates for that.
So the idea is that the sun it orbits is a smaller sun than ours, so it doesn't give us much heat. But the planet orbits in a closer orbit, so it
compensates.
Should compensate.
Yeah, exactly. So what's interesting about this is because Kepler-22b is a bit closer to its sun, and it's in that sort of Goldilocks zone, we're all kind of thinking, oh, well, you know, maybe this is it. Maybe this is the planet that finally is going to show whether or not we're not alone in our universe. A few other interesting facts, though. It's 2.4 times bigger in diameter than Earth. So if we were to go to this planet, gravity would be a bit more intense.
Assuming that the density was similar.
Yeah, that's right. If the planet is hollow, it's not going to be a problem. If it's a really thick rock or something, we might be in for a rough ride. I don't think it's so bad that we wouldn't be able to be on this planet. We might need some kind of super reinforced spacesuits, but it's still conceivable that life could evolve on this planet. It's not that bad.
Well, actually, and you can use an analogy as going underwater. When you go underwater, gravity hasn't changed, but sort of the pressure pushing down on you, which is kind of an equivalent to gravity in this case, can get quite intense. And we have animals that live at quite immense depths and have a lot of atmosphere pushing down on them. So I think 2.4 is well within the range of what life could evolve on.
Pressure and gravity are slightly different, but it doesn't mean, it doesn't preclude life.
Yeah, I'm just using it as an analogy.
Right.
Right. I'm just, you know, for all the our physicist listeners, just putting in a little disclaimer so no one gets upset.
Mass and weight are the same thing.
Don't even.
Yeah, let's not get started. Anyway, the interesting point for me, although we can tell where Kepler-22b is, we can't tell what its atmosphere is. Now, if, and a big if, Kepler-22b has a greenhouse effect, then the temperature on the planet could be around 22 degrees Celsius, which is very welcoming for our style of life form.
Is another implication of that possibly that even if it doesn't have an atmosphere, if we were able to introduce an atmosphere bubble of some sort, that the amount of energy input could actually still sustain sort of a type of environment that would be hospitable to humans?
I think one of the biggest questions here isn't so much the atmosphere per se, is the rock. One of the things we're still not sure about, as we mentioned when we're talking about density, this could be in theory a gas giant, and I put giant in quotation marks. Because again, we don't know the density, and it could be. And there are other planets out there that are slightly smaller than this one that scientists believe are actually just big puffs of hot air. And I think that would be more important.
Or cold air, depending on how far away they were.
Yeah, because I mean, in the Venus, Mars sort of scenario, geoengineering a planet in order to make it habitable is scenarios we've gone through. So I'm quite sure if it was a rocky planet, even if it wasn't warm enough for us, we could make it so. Or if it was too hot, we could make it so whenever we have the technology to travel 600 million light years.
Right.
600. Not million.
No, sorry.
Yeah. Which would be a big... Anyway, but you know, it's funny because I've been thinking about this ever since news broke a couple of weeks ago. I've been thinking about this a lot because I've always held the belief... What?
You're planning to move?
Ethan's looking for a new apartment.
Yeah. I've always believed that there's a very good chance life exists in our universe, that we can't possibly be alone given the size of it. But this is, you know, finding this planet really, I don't know, it gives me added hope. It makes it seem a little bit more likely that life out there exists. And to think, you know, this planet, maybe it has intelligent life, and maybe that intelligent life has formed a civilization, and maybe they're, I don't know, at the Bronze Age, or maybe they're, you know, 500 years more advanced than we are, but maybe they're around the same technological level that we are. Maybe they're just taking their first steps to explore the galaxy. Maybe they have a observatory in outer space similar to our Kepler array, and maybe they're pointing it at Earth, and maybe they're going to see our planet, and they're going to think, wow, there's another planet that's in the Goldilocks zone, and I wonder if they would point, you know, their version of SETI at us and see what they find.
Well, here's the next interesting question.
Yes.
Now, let's say we have these two planets. Would you want them to be 600 years advanced than us, or us 600 years advanced than them? And the reason why I ask is if we both point SETI at each other right now, and we're at the same level of technology, you're not going to hear anything, right?
For a long time.
But if they were 600 years in advance, then in theory, we could hear their radio signals as it's just about hitting Earth.
Right.
Or conversely, if we were sort of 600 years ahead of them, when the time comes, they would be able to hear us.
Yeah. It's an interesting question because, I mean, it all depends on whether or not they're a friendly civilization or if they're not so friendly. I think the fact that the distance itself kind of helps protect us from unfriendly aliens, unless they've mastered faster than light speed technology, which I think is probably unlikely given what we know about physics. Of course, that could change at any time. But honestly, like, I wouldn't care too much as long as they're, you know, equally fascinated by finding life. I think that gives us some input into what they value as a civilization.
What I think is really interesting about these types of discoveries is that the discussions that follow, much like this one, are sort of making all these assumptions that are framing things in our own sort of sphere of understanding. So in all of these discussions, we assume that whatever life is going to be formed is going to need water, is going to be carbon-based, and all life on Earth is, you know, surrounding nucleic acids and based on that, which is probably how life on Earth started to spring up from the primordial ooze we like to talk about in the first place. And I just think that the amazing possibilities for different variations that are very dissimilar from the very basis of all of our biology is really spectacular to think about, that we can't even start to fathom what might be out there because we've never experienced it.
But of course, that runs into the other sort of selection bias problem we will always have. I mean, we may stumble upon something bizarre, but odds are we're going to find something that's sort of carbon-based, lives on water, not because it's the most prevalent.
It's just what we'll see.
That's what we're looking for. We're looking at planets that have water, that are in the Goldilocks zone, that will have a predilection to be life like we know it. And even if the planet right next to it, which may be some demonoid type class planet, may have life on it, we're so, oh, life can't possibly live there. We're going to focus on Kepler 22b.
Well, again, until we find that other example of life, which I think would just, I mean, any discovery of life not on Earth is going to blow open the doors of what we conceive of as life. So whatever that discovery is, whenever it happens, it's going to be amazing. Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll return after this.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Said I thank you, thank you.
Said I thank you, yes I thank you.
The music says it all, but we'd like to say it again. Thank you, from all of us at CITR, for your generous support during our 2011 Fund Drive. We just couldn't do it without you.
You made a million dreams come true, and so I'm saying thank you, a million to you.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Understanding empowers you.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, of course.
I knew you were going to say that.
Are you psychic, Don?
Well, you know, I have been practicing my perceptions of extraordinary sense, and I can read minds.
Really? Well, you might not be the only skeptic who can read minds, as it turns out. You may recall last year a surprising new study by Daryl J. Bem, who published his paper, Feeling the Future, Experimental Evidence for Anomalous Retroactive Influences on Cognition and Effect, in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology.
Wow, that title blows my mind.
It does.
I feel like I would have to read it to understand what's going on.
I'm going to tell you what's going on. This paper appeared to show that ESP, extrasensory perception, was a real phenomenon, and under certain circumstances, in this case erotic photos, it could be demonstrated in a laboratory setting. Now, suffice it to say, many scientists and skeptics were skeptical of the findings of this paper. After all, ESP...
The paper itself, he used erotic photos to show that people would become sort of aroused before they saw the photo. in this show that ESP would work backwards in time.
Yeah, there was also the right? time element with it as well.
Yeah.
But anyway, people were skeptical, and, you know, it's not strange because ESP is an extraordinary claim, and it goes against much of our established evidence of how the brain works and what is physically possible in our universe. And so to prove this claim, we would need equally extraordinary evidence. One of the first steps to establishing the truth or not of the study is to replicate it. And this process means that scientists in different institutions in different locations attempt to follow the same methodology and procedure to get the same results. This would demonstrate if there were errors in the methodology or if the researcher's bias was influencing the results of the study. If the replicating studies could not reproduce the same results, well, there you have evidence that something along the way has gone wrong. Either the new studies are flawed or the original might be flawed, and this kind of trial and error process would get us closer to the truth. So enter Stuart Ritchie, a doctoral student in psychology at the University of Edinburgh, and he attempted to reproduce the study, but he failed to get the same results. But Ritchie found that he couldn't get his negative findings published in journals. And when you consider all the attention that Bem's paper received and the enormous implications of his findings are indeed valid, it seems that follow-up research would seem pretty important. Not only that, but published follow-up studies are very important for the scientific process. When a journal refuses to publish such papers, they're kind of throwing a monkey wrench into the whole scientific method. The error-correcting mechanisms of the scientific method only work when those error corrections get published for the scientific community and enter the sort of debate about the issue. Now, one such example of the difficulties that Ritchie and his team encountered was when they attempted to get their study published in the British Journal of Psychology. They actually sent it up for peer review, and one of the negative reviewers, who didn't have any problems with the methodology, but rather the fact that the three researchers, Richard Wiseman, Chris French, and Stuart Ritchie, were all skeptics, and they all had psychic powers, and were using them to suppress ESP.
Whoa, but what?
Yeah.
Sorry, that strikes me as a bit left field.
And was this written in the review? Like, this paper sucks because you guys all have psychic powers?
Apparently, yeah.
Did he mention ponies or unicorns in the review as well?
I don't think
magic
so.
Magic ponies, regular ponies,
but,
you can
but
mention.
But you never know, right? I mean, maybe the unicorns got in there somehow. The only way that they could get their paper published was if they agreed to do the whole thing all over again, but this time have a believer in ESP run all the participants. Now, despite the fact that this would add an obvious bias to the paper, they're going to proceed. They're, you know, very frustrated with the delay and all the kind of weird stipulations that's been put on them. But again, proceeding as they should.
I'd like to point out that this type of challenge in getting negative or contradictory results published, even if it's not actually going against a strong scientific consensus, like one paper up against a recent paper, is not easy.
Yeah.
It's just not really considered novel. So it's not, even though this subject matter is a little sort of like out in left field, the actual process that they're going through is not particularly strange. And I've had several colleagues who have had to do a bunch of really, really ridiculous experiments, as this one seems to be a ridiculous experiment that they're asking them to do in order to get really viable scientific data published.
You know, actually, see, on one level, them having sort of a negative bias, right? I mean, if they're skeptics, you could argue mm-hmm. that they are sort of negative against it. That I can see. But when they say peer review, and in there they had psychic powers that they were using in this experiment, I mean, who exactly was...
Were these the exact words?
Was reviewing.
This,
Like, how can that be a quote from the review? I don't know if you've ever read these, but they tend to be a little drier than that.
Yeah. Yeah. See, that this is the problem with this study in particular, was that it caught so much attention from the popular media
mm-hmm.
because ESP, oh my goodness, that's so cool. And because it got all this attention, these journals were like, ooh, look at everyone paying attention to us. Yeah, this is really mm-hmm. nice. But they don't want to turn around and go, oh, no, sorry, we were wrong. They want to bask in this glowing, warming glow that they're getting right now. And when, you know, a bunch mm-hmm. of annoying skeptics come along and go, well, actually,
you
it
know,
kind of kills their ride.
I don't know if you can put it on the journal publishers to do that, because they really put a lot of stock in credibility. And so trying to if there is any influence from the publisher rather than just the individual reviewers or the editors and that kind of thing that's having trouble getting this published, I would suspect it's more because they think it's a petty argument that brings down the caliber of the journal compared to, worried about getting press coverage, because in academic circles, it just doesn't matter.
Mm. Well, I mean, that could be true, but I do look at journals like The Lancet, which dragged their feet for, I don't know, 10 years before they retracted the Wakefield paper.
Retractions just don't happen that often, and it's totally deplorable. You're absolutely right. It holds back the scientific process.
But again, they're not asking for it to be retracted. They're asking for a chance to reevaluate the experiment. Because maybe, I mean, I don't know this Ben guy. I don't know if he's known for being a fraud or a woo-woo, as you put it. But if he's trying to do legitimate research, then it does him a disservice to not allow other scientists to...
Well, absolutely. Like with the whole neutrino argument and how those scientists were basically saying, like, you know, this is what we found and it doesn't make any sense. And let's work on this together.
We think we're wrong.
Yeah.
We just don't know where.
Exactly.
We're wrong.
Like, let's work on this as a community, and that's the way that it all should be.
Yeah. Daryl Ben be the peer reviewer who had problems with
things? I think that'd be a conflict of interest if he was peer reviewing.
Usually they're anonymous.
Yeah. Well.
Well, but not in this case.
Yeah, some journals have different policies.
No, but in this particular case, obviously the researchers can use their psychic powers to find out who it was.
Oh, good point.
Yeah.
Good point.
Well, so there's a bit of skeptical news, and we will keep our eye on this, especially because Richard Wiseman, Chris French, have been interviewed on the show in the past, and are also at the forefront of doing really cool science.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually kind of look forward to how they incorporate a believer in ESP.
Yes.
Yeah.
You could answer their data set.
Mm-hmm. But Don, you were telling me about something very interesting.
Well, barefaced citizens.
Mm.
Yes. Women are being denied citizenship if they don't take off their hijab. Okay, this is a topic we've kind of covered in various angles before, yet it never seems to go away. And yes, you can take that in many ways. We're a multicultural society. Why not have multicultural innuendo sort of ideas? So this week, Immigration Minister Jason Kenney, said that in order for wannabe Canadians to take the oath of citizenship and thus become real Canadians, the citizenship judge must see their face, full face. This doesn't seem erroneous, except for a small number of women trying to escape theocratic regimes that deny them their human rights. Those people who are from traditional societies that insist on face covering, most notably Muslims, but in a growing movement in Orthodox Judaism, there's also includes a lot of Jews these days, among, I'm sure, other groups of people, they will not be allowed to take the citizenship oath. They will be given one sort of redo if they change their mind, and then they're back to the end of the line. Kenny said public declarations that you are joining a Canadian family, and it must be taken freely and openly. And he said it's frankly bizarre that women were allowed to wear face veils while they were swearing their citizenship oath.
So just to make one quick point, as far as, you know, some people, yes, are made to wear these things, but some people are made to, and then it becomes a choice. So.
Kenny stated it's not a religious obligation, but a cultural one, pointing out that during the pilgrimage to Mecca, women actually are strictly forbidden to cover their face. So I thought, why not check this out? I mean, we've talked about this, but we've never actually gone into what's the root of this sort of thing. And from my research, I actually turned up only one Quranic verse that sort of supports this cover-up women movement in Islam. Surah 24:31 states that, and telling the believing woman to lower their gaze and guard their private parts, and not to display their adornments except that which ordinarily appears thereof, and to draw their head cover over their chest and not display their adornment except to their Mahram essentially is close kin. So it says, cover your chest, cover your private parts. Other than that, it's kind of vague, which is where you get a lot of interpretations.
Mm-hmm.
Why some people wear the hijab, which just covers their head. The hijab covers their face. and then the burqa, which is essentially a walking tent. It seems like that from the religious text, it's interpretive, it's not doctrinal, so to speak. The Canadian Council of American Islamic Relations is arguing that this is a slap in the face of religious freedoms. They hold that it's a funny way to show people how free Canada is by forcing them to abandon their religious rights to become Canadian citizens.
Is one of the problems that you're seeing with this that they're claiming religion where you don't actually feel it's religion?
They are keeping the me out of this.
Okay.
I don't wear a hijab. I am, and this may shock people, not really a religious person.
So no.
I'm not attempting to defend Islam in any way here. I am giving this maybe a bit more of a positive spin in the defense of those people who don't want to.
I'll reframe my question as, are you describing the argument as people are saying that this isn't really to do with religion? And isn't a question of religious freedom?
So, Kenny is saying that this is not a religious freedom question. This is if you're going to become a member of our society, there are at least some minimum standards that you must broach. One of the minimum standards is when you actually take the oath of office.
Everybody gets to be a country leader when they join Canada.
Oath of office as a citizen. Citizenship is an office with rights and duties. But that is at least a minimum bar.
Right.
And actually, I don't think it's even that hard of a bar if you think about it. Because usually, those people who believe that they need to have the face covered usually only need to have it covered when men are present.
Correct.
So,
well, I don't know.
If we made the exception, you know, I don't think it's an unreasonable accommodation that we had oath swearing ceremonies that were gender based, at least in one or two rare occasions. Because again, we're not talking millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see why this would be an unsurmountable hurdle for them to do. Now, the Canadian Council for American Islamic Relations is taking the opposite view and saying, no, this is purely a religious freedom issue, and that their religion says they get to do this. How dare you try and force them to do otherwise? Of course, ironically enough, in an odd sort of way, I'm one of these people that until you become a citizen of the country, I'm not really sure if you should benefit from the benefits of citizenship, which would include rights and freedoms and that sort of thing, but that's a whole other kettle of fish. Related to this, when I was doing my research, is there's currently, the Supreme Court is listening to arguments in a case where a woman is arguing that she should be able to wear the hijab in her court case, so she's giving testimony. She's trying to testify against two male relatives in a sexual assault case in Ontario. The argument against her is that the judge jury cannot assess the validity of her testimony because they'd be unable to see her facial expressions. So the idea is that, you know, is she lying? Is she nervous? Is there something odd about how she's testifying? And as social animals, we get a lot of those cues by the way you look when you're saying something. As far as her not having to testify in front of her accusers, again, that strikes me as something that's already been covered in other aspects of law and that sort of thing.
Well, on the issue of the woman testifying in Ontario, if they rule that she can't testify having her face covered, doesn't that also mean that if you have a paralyzed face, you can't give testimony in court?
Or that you can't write a statement that's read out in court, because that happens, or record a video that might be recorded several times, or do anything that's not right there, flesh and blood, totally naked in front of you.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think myself that the taking the citizenship oath, there are a few hurdles that I think you should be able to concede to our tradition, for lack of a better word, where you don't need to wear the hijab, right? So when you give the oath of office, sure, maybe some accommodations to make sure it's a women-only sort of thing, great, but do it face open, take the oath. As far as the court case goes, I think your counterexamples are actually quite effective. Because, I mean, yes, we do get a lot of facial cues from looking at how someone looks when they're giving testimony. But either A, as I mentioned, a separate sort of recording of testimony could be made so as to ensure mm-hmm. the modesty of the person. Or B, I mean, like you say, we give written testimony, there's that sort of thing. And the judge may, in the back of their mind, say, well, I couldn't see their face,
yeah.
so I may alter how much weight
exactly.
I give that to.
Then it's sure, the choice of the person testifying and knowing those types of consequences. And on a related note, as far as, you know, the issues with the citizenship, as well as those kind of laws in things that are controlled by law, such as what you can do and can't do in court, it seems like the country is sort of reluctant to... It doesn't seem like there's a right answer and a wrong answer so much as as a country we need to decide, you know what I mean, and take a stand on where... what's acceptable, set the rules, and then that's what it is. Because there's no intrinsically right or wrong way to run a country, to run immigration, to have those policies in place. It just seems like the indecision and the murkiness of those type of policies are making more trouble than any one decision possibly could.
I would say, though, that while you're doing that, you also have to assess if you're not just adding pointless barriers. If there's a problem with people coming into Canada with their faces covered and taking a citizenship oath, I don't know, maybe they're secretly terrorists or they're laughing or I don't know what it is, they have bad teeth maybe, sure, then we'll have rules. But I want to see some evidence that there's actually a problem with this.
You want a dental exam
well,
for citizenship.
Like, it just seems like you're adding... It's sort of like, you know, Occam's razor, right?
Yeah.
We don't add silly assumptions to a theory. So show me the evidence that there's a problem first.
On the other hand, your definition of a problem is going to be very different than someone else's definition. So I am going to bet a lot of money that there's going to be a lot of people in this country that say that, you know, not wanting to come to Canada, take off whatever you're wearing and immediately putting on a Canadian t-shirt is a problem.
Yeah.
Because, you know what I mean? Like to have a strong desire to continue to retain your previous national identity is a problem. And so there's always going to be different definitions of what a problem is for any amount of that. And that's why I think we just need to take obviously everyone in the country isn't going to decide, but as a governing body to decide what the rules are and then have those, you know, people are going to have that knowledge when they decide to make that choice.
Yeah, I would think that it's not so much the problem. Is you are, in a way, being reborn as a new person. And one of the things about being here is to be free and to be open. And, okay, maybe it's the only time you're ever going to have your hijab off in public. And that is a landmark thing, and I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing in itself. It also allows...
That's coming from one set of motivations,
well,
though.
Well, no, but it also allows for those people who have never been allowed to, not from choice, but from family or dictate, to see this place is different and you can be free. You can do this one thing. And again, it's not like they have to do this every day of their life. They were doing this every day of their life, totally different kettle of fish.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This is sort of a one-time thing. I'm making a bold statement that I am joining the family of Canada and this is one of the hoops, and as anachronistic as it may be, because as Jenna well points out, life is flux and things change and we're in a moment of change. I mean, this was not an issue 100 years ago because we didn't have a sufficient number of people coming over that would make this an issue.
Right.
And before that, we were busy killing everyone different than us.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to a commercial break and we'll be back with more on Radio Free Thinker.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star. Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Jenna.
Yes.
Tell us about this mountain of data or data.
Mountain of data or
it's
data.
Raining data.
I'm just going to go with data because it rolls off my tongue a little easier. I don't know about anybody else's tongues. I try and stay away from them mostly. So first, we have to talk a little bit about DNA and DNA sequencing technology. So I know everybody pretty much hears about DNA sequencing in some capacity or another. So, you know, forensic television shows, of which there are far too many, and descriptions of new scientific discoveries. We're all always hearing about DNA and DNA sequencing. So what this technology actually gives us and also requires of us as scientists is not always that well understood, no matter how much we hear about it. So the power and limitations of all the sequencing going on in labs across the globe was recently brought to my attention through one of my research projects. And I found it really striking, and I'd like to provide a little bit of a breakdown of the data overflow that we've been sort of arguably reluctant to acknowledge as a scientific community. So first off, a little bit about genome sequencing and what it is.
DNA sequencing.
Yes, so your genome is made up of DNA. So as, you know, all the blueprints, as we also often call them, to build a human being or really any other biological entity like we were talking about earlier, are all contained in our DNA. So DNA, for those of us who need a reminder, is sort of like, it stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. Because it's missing an oxygen compared to RNA. Anyhow, so it's kind of like, you can think of it as a long string-like molecule, and it's made up of four different components. And these are usually abbreviated as the bases A, C, G, and T.
What do those letters mean?
Adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thiosine.
Oh, okay.
Oh, so those are the proteins
that actually
comprise the links in...
DNA isn't made of protein, it's made of these bases. So, they can exist as independent molecules or be strung together in these long chains that make up DNA. So DNA is kind of like this chain that's built up of different colored links, you can sort of think of it, and they can occur in any order. And the order or sequence of these different pieces that holds the coded information. So when we talk about genome sequencing, genome being the sum of all the DNA that's in any particular being, we're talking about determining the sequence written out as A, C, G's, and T's, literally long strings of letters, determining the sequence of all that DNA in a human cell or plant cell or bacterial or squid or what have you. So just to give you an idea of scale that we're talking on here, the E. coli genome, which is a bacteria, would have about 4.6 million letters if you wrote them out, while the human genome would be a list of about 3.2 billion A, C's, G's, and T's, which really makes you go cross-eyed if you're going to look at it for very long. So that's what we're talking about when we're talking about genome sequencing, is determining these strings of letters.
Has anyone ever found Shakespeare's sonnets in it?
Seriously, if you look at these things for too long, you start to see words, let me tell you. So what does this technology allow us to do scientifically? So there's this field of bioinformatics. So some of the applications of DNA sequencing that we all hear about are fairly obvious. We know that the sequence of any individual's DNA is completely unique to that person, with the proviso, unless they have an identical twin. And so your DNA sequence can be used to specifically identify you. That's right. You, Ethan.
Great.
Because our DNA holds the information for our biological makeup, it also holds information about any congenital diseases or perhaps risk factors for other conditions that might have environmental factors as well. So as genome sequencing has become more and more accessible, there are, of course, issues with privacy and that kind of thing that have come up, and we've heard a lot about in the news and that kind of thing as far as personalized medicine and screening and whatnot.
I know my geeky science sort of looking around things. I thought genomics was like yesterday's news, and it's all epigenetics with the, you know, it's not so much the genes, it's how the genes get expressed, and the genes that express the genes, and that sort of.
So, one of the it's not that genetics isn't important, it's that epigenetics was not previously recognized, and the importance of that wasn't. So, you can't have gene expression unless you have the genes there.
Is that because genes are selfish? That's a little Richard Dawkins joke, thanks.
Little one.
They are. Yeah. All genes are selfish. So anyhow, yeah, there's lots of social issues that come up that we think of when we think of genome sequencing, but it turns out there's a lot of scientific issues as well, and there's entirely different sort of realm of usefulness and problems that come up when you start thinking of research and genome sequencing. So evolution proceeds by random DNA mutation events, and this eventually, you know, one mutation stacked on another mutation stacked on another mutation eventually leads to developing different species and the amazing variety of beings that we know in our world today. So the DNA actually sort of holds this pathway of evolution that you can track back by looking at things that are related to each other. So by comparing DNA of different species, we can actually trace their evolutionary trajectory and classify their genetic level of relatedness to each other. So we've heard that we're very closely related, in air quotes, to the chimpanzee, for example. And this genome sequencing technology allows us to evaluate these types of relationships for all biological entities if we know their genome sequence. So you can imagine the kind of power that that gives you. It's really valuable in a lot of different kinds of research contexts. So this sounds really great, right? So we got lots of data. We got lots of information.
And you can,
awesome.
More information you have, the better to make
decisions. Exactly.
Research. You can never have too much information.
Well, the problem is when I say a lot of data, I mean lot of data. You'll remember the bacterial E. coli genome has several million base pairs. And as more and more genomes are sequenced, mostly bacterial at this point, just because they're easier to grow than bunnies, this number is multiplying like crazy. We're talking about information for billions upon billions upon billions of letters in DNA sequences. And this amount of data can be really difficult to process, which is really the key. It's not too much information, it's our ability to deal with it. The problem is basically being able to see the signal through the noise of so much data. How do you pick out what's significant or what's normal or what's connected to what? Because it's so difficult to look at the total sum of all that data. Obviously, analyzing this kind of amount of information can't be done manually. So researchers have developed tools to look at all this bioinformatic data. And many of these tools have been adopted as standards in the field. So on one hand, adopting standardized methods allows things to be processed more quickly, sort of like having a known routine that you perform to get your answer out. Using standard tools also allows different scientists to compare results that are produced in different laboratories. So if everyone were doing their own thing in isolation, it would be really hard to advance any science because you wouldn't be able to collaborate and combine results to come up with a bigger picture. However, there are major problems with using standard tools. And one of the challenges that arise in biological research is that these problems don't tend to be particularly standard. So a lot of the time, different methods are required to approach each unique problem. We weren't, as we all know, designed. Therefore, we don't have sort of these standard issues that you can compare. Everything is slightly different, and using the same tools is hard.
Sort of the opposite of, you know, if the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. This here is, you have all sorts of bizarre things out there, and you have no real tools in your hand per se.
Or trying to build an entire house with only one size of screwdriver. You know, sometimes different tools require different sizes. You can't...
IKEA.
Hey, they have different sizes. Maybe all their Allen keys are the same. Perhaps more important than, you know, needing different tools for different different applications, many of the most popular biological data processing tools were actually designed at a time when less data was available. So as more and more sequence information becomes available, these programs are still powerful, but a lot of care needs to be taken with how they're applied. So when people get too comfortable using a standard set of tools in a predetermined way, they might not take a close enough look at how well those tools are actually performing the job, and this can lead to major misunderstandings of the biological world. So if we're going to go to all the trouble of generating all this amazing data, we should really do our best to listen to what it can tell us. So I mentioned that I had an example of this that came up in my research lately. So to give you a more concrete example, I've been working for the past 4.5 years on my PhD in biochemistry, and most of this time has been spent studying a specific type of protein. So reading the literature, scientific literature, not just sort of anachronino, which I do enjoy, I had a specific understanding of these proteins, and it happened to be the same understanding as most scientists who worked with the same proteins. Basically, you know, they only occurred in bacteria, they only performed a specific reaction, most of them had a second subunit, etc. The bottom line was that there was a certain stereotype for what these proteins were assumed to be. And everything else that was found was sort of considered to be a weird one of these proteins. So I kind of like to think of this as an alien looking at one person on the street and thinking that all people have an umbrella red hair and are kind of fat. When really that's only a very small subset of people. So for years, people had been using the standard tools to look at the sequencing for these proteins in those vast databases I was talking about. So how this works is you basically plug in a sequence and the program spits out a bunch of things that look like it. And specifically look the most like it of all the proteins in the database. So because there's so much data, the program was spitting out things that looked a lot like the original submission. So people thought that that's what they all look like. So to go back to the alien example, if the alien performed the same type of search, taking the red-haired, umbrella-laden fat man and asking his flying saucer computer to search for things that looked like it, if the alien asked for the top 50 things that look like that in a specific community park, say, they might see a lot of variety in the types of people the program spit out because there just weren't that many people there to begin with. But as you increase the number of people you search, the amount of data, the search results are going to be more and more similar. So if you look for 50 things that look like the red-haired fat umbrella man in the whole world, you're probably going to come up with a room of near doppelgangers. So moving from fat men back to proteins, I started to challenge the idea that all of these proteins really were so similar and went about collecting all of the known sequences of these proteins to analyze them. This isn't all that easy. As I said, it's a lot of data. So even for this one little specific type of protein, there were thousands of sequences. And when all was said or done, a very different picture emerged than that stereotype. That profile of the protein that people had understood before turned out to be a very small subset of the actual group. So much like how assuming all people look like the rainy day umbrella man, using this profile to describe the whole family of proteins turned out to be very, very wrong.
Isn't that part of the way they do sort of genetic searches and that sort of thing? Is what they call barcoding. Is, you know, they look for like three markers, and hey, if it's got these three markers, it's the same. They simplify the search process to make it simpler.
Well, even things like it's sort of not exactly the same topic, but when you're, for example, when they do DNA testing for criminal investigations and that kind of thing, they're not actually sequencing the entire genome of a person. They're looking for very specific sites and looking for basically a fingerprint in DNA form that is a lot more specific than an actual fingerprint, but is not looking at the entire data set. So that's one way to simplify things and sort of condense that data down. The problem that I'm illustrating here is sort of it becomes very difficult to glean anything from the data without already knowing what you're looking for, because anything that you're going to look for is going to be out there.
Well, yeah, it's the inverse of it. So instead exactly. of asking the question, does it have these three things, you look and these are the three things that are common, therefore I ignore everything else.
But there's no way to tell if it's actually common if that's what you're looking for, because there's so much out there that it's very hard to tell what is the majority, what is the minority, because it's so difficult to look at the entire data set. You don't know whether or not your sample is representative of the whole thing, and that is more the crux of it.
How do you know your sample is
representative? Because I know for sure that my sample is representative of all the sequences that are currently in the database. This is not representative of all of the biology on Earth, because as I mentioned, most of the sequences that are in the databases are actually bacteria, because the technical, physical challenges in doing the sequencing is a lot easier for bacteria. So these are overrepresented in the databases, and there aren't that many sort of plants and animals and that kind of thing anywhere near the type of number of those higher organisms than of bacteria. So although this analysis is fully representative of the database that's out there now, because I collected all the sequences using different methodology, it's not necessarily representative of what's out there.
So again, just to stretch this analogy, yeah.
Yeah.
So your research found that, no, they are not redheaded, umbrella-wearing fat men. They're more like beach ball-wearing thin people with brown hair.
No, more like they can look like any of these people that you find in the park.
But doesn't that sort of now how do you define what it is you are looking at? Because
they have two legs, they have a torso, they have arms, and they have heads, which is more what a human looks like than a red-haired thing carrying an umbrella.
But doesn't that lose some of the power of the classification in the first place? Because again, there must be lots of things out there that are two-legged, body, two arms. That don't fit into this one particular category of protein you're looking at, and it may actually overlap with another protein that has
right.
X, Y, and Z. It's a different beast.
Right, but the thing is that the original. So, if you're going to classify all humans as having umbrellas, that's not powerful, because you're not understanding what a human really is.
What I'm getting at is, I agree.
That was only the first part of my point.
I know. The umbrella, red hair, fat person, far too small
yep.
to make the stereotype. But where do you and how do you cleave? At what point is this representation is generic enough to be useful,
mm-hmm.
but not so generic as to be limiting?
Well, and this is the thing, is you can't do that in a necessarily standard way. So for proteins, there are really... there are specific criteria that classify things as a certain protein family. And then there are sort of different, it's almost like taxonomy, different levels. So you can have a protein fold family and then a protein family and then sort of a subfamily that does a specific thing and then a different clade of that. And, you know, but all of these designations are somewhat fluid because, again, there's no overall design to this. There isn't defined levels that are going to work right across the board. But in order to be able to see the real picture, you need to be able to look at all of the data. And with the amount of data we have right now, it's really difficult. And so my basic point is now that all these tools and these methodologies that are very, very common in use right now were developed in a time when there was less data available. And so unless people are being very, very careful to account for the amount of information we have now, it's really easy to analyze things in very accepted, like historically accepted ways and come up with completely erroneous conclusions.
So we should just give up.
No, you never just give up. So, I mean, it sounds like I've been describing the problem as too much data. And no, I'm not suggesting that we stop generating data. The situation in bioinformatics that we've been talking about It can be a little counterintuitive, like you were saying, you know, mainly because in most circumstances we're criticizing studies for not having enough data. And yes, you know, more data has the potential to give us more information, but only if, and it's a big if, we can analyze it properly. So the same way that, you know, conspiracy theories and some superstitions or just plain wrong beliefs spring from seeing patterns in noise, you know, or this clumpiness of data that we talk about, this mountain of data that we have can be made to basically mean anything. If you're looking for something, like I said, you're going to find it. So as with anything you want information from, you have to approach it analytically and not automatically. So really taking a look at what each problem requires and making sure that your sample is fully representative and to use the right tools for this situation. And software developers are doing a fantastic job of coming up with new tools. And people, you know, we need to be faster at adopting the right tools for the right applications, not only in bioinformatics, but really in any level of science because it's advancing so quickly.
I know one way you could sort of jumpstart this is if you're doing research into porn. If you said, oh, this information will improve porn, and then you will get so much money thrown at it, it would be ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't know who's going to throw too much money at that. But I'm just curious. I mean, like, who is designing these programs that are being used?
They're people with cross-training in software development and biology.
Mm. So it's not like Microsoft Excel?
No. Okay. No.
So essentially people who weren't good enough at computer science is designing the software because they are good enough in biology.
The reality of it is who usually develops it is people who happen to have some sort of skill level at computer development or software development and are seeing a need for a program that does a certain thing. So oftentimes people's projects will actually be sort of taken over by their desire to develop a tool because they see the need.
I don't mean this facetiously, but I'm sure there's a lot of cross-pollination for something like Google searches or advertising who have spent years and decades data mining for market research.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure they have tons of tools that probably could be quite useful in your area if you change sort of the question and the data.
It's all, yeah, sort of based on the same type of methodology.
Yeah, the search algorithms, sort of thing, would be similar, even though their applications are...
It's more to do with, like, the question design itself. One of the programs that I was describing really looks for exact sequences and tries to find the best match for those sequences of letters. And other ones will ignore most of the letters but look for specific motifs that are representative of something known. And certain ones will look for specific structures and that kind of thing. So it has to do with the questions that you're asking the program. The questions that you're asking through using a specific program, sort of what method you're using to interrogate the database.
Well, either way, we'll have to keep our eye on this. I mean, we don't want a mountain of data
burying science
that just buries us under this, you know, inoperable pile of A's and G's and stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, good for you, Jenna. We're running out of time, so let's go into our skeptical highlights.
I have two skeptic highlights this week. One, a quick one. A history of violence. I think Ethan had mentioned something about Steve Pinker the other day. Apparently, at the World Federalist Meeting, yes, we've had issues with the World Federalist Meeting, but apparently they are having Harvard professor Steve Pinker do a discussion as to why we are living in the most peaceful era of human development. It's going to be held at the United Church of Vancouver, which is 494 West 49th Street, December 15th, 2011, 7:30. Pardon me. The other highlight I have is, are you a moral person? I doubt it, but we can test it. The BBC has an online test of morality as part of a research project by Dr. Robert Unger. The test your morality experiment is designed to look at a new theory based on something called human superorganism theory that he hopes will help us understand the diversity and sources of our morality. It postulates that we are part of a superorganism, hopefully not Jungian, but that's a whole other issue, which helps define our personal morality. The new theory suggests that all moral actions are based on fundamental need to, quote, police society in order to keep the superorganism functioning properly, and that everyone in a social group inadvertently plays the role of unofficial policeman by making judgments about how others behave. Moral actions, according to this theory, is driven by the expectation of punishment if we don't properly carry out our role within our super organism properly. In the morality test, you'll be asked to respond to a variety of scenarios in which people are doing things that you may or may not agree with. You will ask about how disgusted and angry the scenarios make you, and whether you would want to avoid or punish these people who are doing them. You can learn how your moral responses to the scenarios compare to the worldwide population. And in the end of the experiment, you'll be given a, quote, detailed feedback about it. It was interesting when I took it. I questioned some of the philosophical background of it, but it was still kind of cool, and the link will be on our website. It's part of BBC Labs project. They have other experiments there. So I thought that was interesting.
Excellent. Well, I will be doing a talk for the Philosopher's Cafe, and this is my skeptical highlight, a talk that is called Bearing Witness to Witness Testimony, A Skeptic's Approach. And this talk will take place on Wednesday, January 18th, 2012, at 7 p.m. at the Jewish Museum and Archives of British Columbia, located on 6184 Ash Street here in Vancouver. And it's going to be pretty interesting, if I don't say so myself, because I'm going to be there. And I'll be talking about how we can skeptically analyze eyewitness testimony and how we incorporate it into historic narratives of important dramatic events, like, say, the history of the Holocaust or 9/11 or the War on Terror. Should be very interesting, and I encourage you to come hear me talk.
My highlight is a holiday suggestion. So I know a lot of people, you know, think that it's very rude not to, you know, accept gifts and try and use them as well as you can, and that people should, you know, get new things that you buy for them specifically. And I would like to suggest establishing a re-gifting pile in your house. If you get something that you think is quite nice but you don't want to use, don't throw it out, don't stick it in a corner to, you know, collect dust. Maybe instead of buying something and you know, consuming a little bit more the next time that you need a small gift for someone, just go to the re-gifting pile and pass it all along. If we think logically about things, we don't have to be tied up with, you know, emotional connections to small gifts.
But big gifts we can keep.
Anything you want, you can keep. If you don't want it, give it away.
All right.
Sort of a Christmas recycling program.
Yeah. It's green.
I like that.
Yep.
Well, this is Ethan, your free thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And this is Jenna saying the real world is amazing.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars, a still more glorious dawn.